can turn the world on with her smile. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. If you're wondering what to do tonight, I have got the solution for you. We got Busted Pencils coming live from the Madison Tap Room of the Minocqua Brewing Company. That's going to be at 6 p.m., just following the Devil's Advocates. You're going to want to check it out. They're going to be doing that once a month throughout the summer to promote public education, and I couldn't think of any better way to introduce my next guest, who is on the education beat for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome, Rory Linane, incredibly intrepid reporter helping us all understand what is going on in the education space here in the state of Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's definitely a lot to keep track of.
Oh my goodness. I was pulling some of your bylines and I thought, we can't possibly talk about all of this, the great reporting you've done, Rory. So I hope this isn't the only time you'll join the Maggie Dawn Show, but let's jump right in there. One of your most recent articles is talking about the fiscal crises that is facing so many of our public primary and secondary schools throughout the state. How did we get here? What's going on?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest reasons for this is dates back to the early 90s. State lawmakers set caps on how much school districts are allowed to raise in tax revenue. And so that every school district just got locked in on what they happened to be spending at that time. And so since then, that, you know, especially in the last 15 years, has not kept up with inflation. So it's been, you know, year after year, you've heard school districts talking about fiscal cliffs and how and making cuts and how they're going to make that work. And so that's been an issue. And then as well, we've seen declining enrollment in a lot of public schools across the state. So that poses another financial challenge. And then also in the mix is the federal pandemic relief funding. And a lot of schools have kind of used that as a crutch to get through these times and started using some of those funds for just basic services that they need to now try to sustain. So all these factors are kind of coming at them at once, and a lot of school districts are looking at cuts or turning to their local voters with referendums to try to raise their local funding.
And I want to be sure everybody caught where you began, and that is that since 1993, Wisconsin school districts have had revenue limits that were put in place by state government. And those revenue limits since 1993 have not been increased for inflation. That's, I'm getting that correct?
Yeah, I think in some years they may have, but in over, if you look at the last 15 years, like since the 2007-08 recession, that has not at all kept up with inflation.
So on a real dollar basis, they actually get less funding today. And that's not just the big school districts, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee. It's every school district actually gets less today in real dollars from the state to help educate our kids in our public schools than they did back in 1993.
Truly, yeah, the actual buying power, yeah, is less.
Is reduced. It's shocking to me. And you reported and mentioned just now that there are about 800,000 students in Wisconsin public school districts, which is about a drop of 6% from 5 years ago. What do we know why there's been such a large decline in public school enrollment?
Some of it is just declining birth rates. But also, especially in Milwaukee, a lot of it is from more students who are attending independent charter schools or private schools, especially with state-funded vouchers.
Yeah, and I think that certainly deserves emphasis. And that is, we're spending a lot of money, but a lot of it isn't staying within our public school systems. We know that the Green Bay School Board has voted to close three schools. This is as of January. Wauwatosa School District is considering closing two schools. Other districts have closed schools recently. Waukesha, West Allis, Cudahy, Kenosha School Board has made cuts to staff benefits. We know MPS just got done with an enormous funding referendum, but just announced late last week that they are still cutting 288 positions. When does this stop? How do we fix this problem? Because I think all of us want our public schools to succeed, and we want our students and children to succeed.
Yeah, and just a quick clarification on the MPS point. That was in Superintendent Keith Posley's proposed budget that came out Friday night. So it will still go through the school board, who could make some changes to that budget. But that's what we're initially looking at, is still facing some of those cuts. And to your point, it does seem like, you know, there's been comments made that MPS could have to come back and do this again in a few years if things don't change at the state level in terms of funding resources. They could still be looking at a projected deficit. There are also other things they can look at to cut costs, including potentially closing some schools.
It's incredible. And this on top of some reporting that came out just earlier this month from you, Rory, the compensation for Wisconsin teachers has dropped 19% since 2010. Tell me my eyes deceive me when I read that headline. We're still running deficits, but teacher comp is down 19%. Where's that coming from?
Well, yeah, and that is adjusted for inflation, so keep that in mind. It's gone down when you adjust for inflation, and especially if you compare to other career paths with, you know, that require a similar educational background. It's very difficult to be a teacher right now. So that's putting that's making it really hard for school districts to find teachers. And a lot of school districts are saying they'd like to raise those wages more, but it's difficult with the budgets that they're working with. That also can be traced in part to the effects of Act 10, and teachers unions are not able to negotiate for raises any more than the inflationary amount. So if there's, you know, one year that teachers can't get that inflationary raise, then they can't make up for it the next year because they're kind of limited in what they can negotiate for there.
It really seems like our public schools and our educational system is facing like a Bermuda Triangle, a perfect storm of factors coming together. Another bit of data that your recent reporting pointed out was that teachers in the state of Wisconsin are overwhelmingly white. That has been the case for a long time. Is there any movement in that number? Is it more or less? Are we trying to attract more teachers of colors? I mean, in the 21-22 school year, about 95% of Wisconsin's public school teachers were white and 76% were female. Wow. I mean, 71% of our teachers are white women. That seems incredible to me. I'm sure that's interacting in part due to the depressed wages as well. Are there efforts out there to try to increase diversity in the ranks of teachers?
There definitely are efforts out there. It's something a lot of people are talking about and working on, but the progress is not really bearing out in the actual numbers in the workforce. So that's definitely a huge area that needs a lot of improvement.
You also noted in your reporting, this is just from this past April 11th. You can find this at the Journal Sentinel Online. That's jsonline.com. I'm joined this half hour by JS reporter Rory Linane. You note also, when we're talking about the demographics of teachers, that a 2022 study found that Black students who had at least one Black teacher were 13% more likely to graduate from high school. That's pretty extraordinary. I think this is an area that we all hope to see some significant improvements in. And yet, at the same time, we want more diverse teachers. We see that there has been an increased politicization of school boards and the makeup of school boards. Reporting again from this month, following just this last election cycle, that Republican-backed candidates, many running on anti-woke platforms, have seen gains in their representation in especially Wisconsin suburban school boards. What are you observing, Rory, when you look at the makeup of school boards and the politics driving what used to be kind of sleepy, nonpartisan school board elections?
Yeah, and Wisconsin isn't alone in this one. That's something we're seeing across the country is just an increasing focus from the political parties on educational issues and finding that, you know, recruiting candidates for school boards is a good way to start a candidate in your party and then, you know, see them succeed potentially at higher offices as well. And the education issues are very motivating to get voters out to polls. So there's a lot of benefits to the political parties getting for them to get involved in these races. But then, yeah, the impact at the local level is you end up seeing a lot of discourse about national issues happening in these local elections where that might not necessarily be a real issue happening in that school district, but people are kind of just turning toward those national talking points and looking at the party endorsements as they're trying to figure out who to vote for or trying to learn about these candidates. And I focused specifically on Waukesha County, where we've seen the Republican Party try something kind of more unique, where they have an initiative called WIS Red. And so they vet candidates for a school board and then provide like other WIS Red candidates will endorse them. They'll do private events and send out mailers, et cetera.
It's incredible to me because I used to work in government, and the thing that I always want to see from elected leaders in government is not putting partisan ideas over good public policy, doing what our kids need to be done. I fear hearing your reporting, this movement called WIS Red, that we're politicizing education in a way that we just never have before. I don't really think, and again, these are my opinions, not my guest Rory Linane's opinions, but you know, when we politicize education in this way, when we inject this invective from our national political dialogue into what are oftentimes brass tacks, the meat and potatoes of running school districts that school boards are responsible for, that we're setting ourselves up for certain disaster. How large and mobilized are these WIS Red movements? We're going to continue that conversation with my guest this half hour, our Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter, Rory Linane. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Stay put, everybody. The discussion continues. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Listen, if Busted Pencils doesn't draw your attention in for this evening's live broadcast at 6 p.m. from the Minocqua Brewing Company, not to worry, we have got the Brewers game. They are playing the Tampa Bay Rays this evening at 6.05 p.m. You can check that out on News from the Center, WRCE, RJN and Racine, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, all available for free on the Civic Media app. So any way you want to spend your afternoon, Civic Media has got you covered. My guest this half hour is Journal Sentinel reporter Rory Linane, who is on the education beat. You can find her work at jsonline.com. We've been talking about Red WIS. Am I getting that right? Is that the name?
WIS Red.
WIS Red. Good inversion there. WIS Red, which is now an organized political movement in the state to seed conservative candidates largely on an anti-woke platform into school board elections, largely as a proving ground for moving on to higher office, building up a candidate base. How widespread, how many school districts are we talking about that WIS Red is touching, Rory?
They're in the Waukesha County area, so all of the districts in Waukesha County, maybe a dozen off the top of my head.
Is there a place that people can go to find out more about WIS Red?
I would say Google my story, jsonline.com, WIS Red.
I love it. Your editor will be very pleased. I also support the plug. We mentioned
they do before, also have a Facebook page.
So you can check it out on Facebook. But if you want the real scoop, you got to go check out Rory's work at jsonline.com. We mentioned in our last conversation that Superintendent Keith Posley has put forth a proposed budget for the Milwaukee Public Schools that, despite the approval by a very narrow margin of a massive funding referendum in the city of Milwaukee, that new budget still proposed to cut 288 staff positions. What has been the reaction to that budget proposal and what comes next?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are, first of all, still trying to make sense of it. It's like a huge budget, so people are still literally trying to understand what these positions are, how many of them may already be vacant, or how many are actually people in these positions that might get moved around. But there is definitely initial concern and some confusion. The school board did always say they were facing a $200 million deficit, and this referendum is only providing $140 million. So, you know, we knew that there was still going to be a gap there. But a lot of people are frustrated that they, you know, turned out and narrowly approved this referendum, and we're still seeing some cuts from positions that people care a lot about. So there are concerns about that. And I think we'll see that bear out as the school board discusses this. And, you know, people will probably rally around trying to keep certain positions in the budget.
Yeah, to give you folks a sense of the scale of this budget, excuse me, the MPS proposed budget is basically just shy of $1.5 billion. So it is indeed a massive budget. The cuts include about 149 teacher positions, of which 130 are considered to be teacher coaching positions. Also 44 educational assistants, 27 administrators, 13 school nurses, and 9 health assistants, 9 social workers, and 3 psychologists. I'll tell you what I hear from my friends that are teaching in Milwaukee Public Schools. They absolutely don't want to see fewer psychologists, fewer social workers, fewer school nurses or health assistants, let alone fewer in-classroom people that are there to help out. Has Milwaukee, the MTEA, responded yet, Rory?
Not yet. I expect to be hearing from them sometime soon, I would expect, but I haven't heard comments from them yet.
And just as a point of reference, the referendum approved by City of Milwaukee voters is going to result in an additional tax of about $2.16 per $1,000 of assessed property value, according to MPS projections. So again, it is a big referendum. Remind everybody what the size of the referendum was that voters just approved this past April.
That'll provide about $140 million for this upcoming school year.
Big numbers, even in a $1.5 billion budget, just shy of about, I won't do the math on air because I don't want to embarrass myself. I also wanted to ask you about, you've been reporting, and there's been some, I don't know if I want to call it gossip, but there's some friction going on the Milwaukee Public Schools School Board related to board member Aisha Carr. What's going on here? There's an investigation. They're looking at her phone location data. What's going on? Do we know what the tension here is?
Yeah, there might be more that we don't know than what we know. But in terms of what we know that the district attorney's office at least was investigating Aisha Carr for potentially living outside of the district that she represents and potentially misrepresenting her address in official documents. And so we know that in January, they got a warrant to get her cell phone data to try to show where she was spending time, basically, to figure out whether she was actually living in her district or not. And she had been voting outside her district. So that could also be an issue. Even if she was living in her district, then why was she voting outside her district? So that warrant got unsealed recently, so that's how we saw that. But the DA's office hasn't gotten back to me or other media, I don't believe either yet, in terms of whether that investigation is ongoing. We have not seen charges filed related to that, so we don't know exactly where that one stands. And then separately, there's also potentially a investigation on the school board side. So there was a misconduct complaint that the school board heard in closed session. They didn't say who it was about or what it was about. But Aisha Carr believed, going into that meeting, she believed it was likely about herself. And, you know, there's a lot that could be related to. We don't know. But there was a recording leaked online where she had told someone that she had planted a recording device in the superintendent's office. And so then she later told me that she had been lying when she said that, trying to kind of prove that the person she was talking to was untrustworthy. And so
I just want to get that straight. So there was a recording about a recording device,
yeah,
which she then said she was lying about to prove that the person that she recorded about the recording device was untrustworthy. I think I got that
the person
straight.
Yeah, I don't know if she recorded that conversation, but the person she was talking yeah, she said that she was lying to the person she was talking to on that recording, if that makes sense.
In different times, this would probably be a very splashy headline every day. But with all else happening in the state of Wisconsin in politics, you can check out the details from Rory Linane, reporter from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can find her work at jsonline.com on the education beat. So important to each and every one of us here in the state of Wisconsin. Thank you for your work, Rory. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much, everybody. Your farm update is next. And then, of course, I'm going back to Bill Barr, the bag man over decades for three, count them three, U.S. presidents. You're not going to want to miss it. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I've been talking today about one of the most dangerous men in the world. And it's not Vladimir Putin. It's not Recep Erdogan. It's not the leader of North Korea. And today, it's not Donald Trump. It's Bill Barr, an attorney general who I think lacks any moral compass, to be perfectly blunt, and has been involved in so many cover-ups, it's really hard to keep track. But don't worry, I'm here to help you do exactly that. Before my last guest, Journal Sentinel reporter Rory Linane, we were going back in time. Back to the Iran-Contra affair, which really, again, has two parts. The first part was that Ronald Reagan had a secret deal with the Ayatollah to ensure that the hostages that had been taken would not be released before the 1980 presidential election to ensure that Jimmy Carter lost that election. That's part of the scandal, part one. The second part was that in exchange for doing that, the United States, mainly those conspiring in the United States, would sell arms to Iran. This was illegal, of course, because there was an arms embargo. And then the money from the sale of the arms to Iran would go to fund the Contras, which was an anti-Sandinistan rebel group in Nicaragua. Why was the United States interested in that if you weren't around then or didn't pay any attention? This would be during the period of time where the Red Scare was a big thing, like the USSR, we needed to fight communism and socialism at all costs. Well, the Sandinistas in power in Nicaragua were socialists, so hence we've got to, you know, give money to the Contras. But I have digressed into an explanation of Iran-Contra just to refresh everyone's recollection. In 1992, the independent counsel Lawrence Walsh was ready to potentially charge Caspar Weinberger for crimes related to Iran-Contra. But Bill Barr stepped in and on Christmas Eve convinced George H.W. Bush to pardon Caspar Weinberger, as well as numerous others, including people who had already been convicted. And in doing so, by eliminating the risk for Caspar Weinberger, his incentive to cooperate with the independent counsel evaporated. And it became impossible for the independent counsel's investigation to proceed, which of course guaranteed that a personal diary kept by H.W. Bush would not be reviewed, it wouldn't be turned over to the special prosecutor. And basically, again, by Bill Barr's suggestion, in for a penny, in for a pound, don't just pardon Caspar Weinberger, but wipe out 3 guilty pleas and 2 pending cases, which effectively decapitated the independent counsel's investigation into the Iran-Contra affair. That independent counsel, Lawrence Walsh, was angry, to say the very least. He bitterly condemned the president's action, charging that, quote, the Iran-Contra cover-up, which has continued for more than 6 years, has now been completed. This is according to Times reporting at that time back in 1992. Independent counsel Walsh added that the diary and notes he wanted access to and to enter into a public trial of Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, represented, quote, evidence of a conspiracy amongst the highest ranking Reagan administration officials to lie to Congress and the American public. Evidence of a conspiracy amongst the highest ranking Reagan administration officials to lie to Congress and the American public. Again, the public trust that attorneys general, special counsels, and public sector lawyers swear an oath to work on behalf of should be sacrosanct. Bill Barr is about as far as you can come from that as imaginable. And his corruption didn't end with Iran-Contra. He also helped cover up the illegal sale of weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein in the late 80s and early 90s. Lovely, isn't it? Oh, by the way, it was those very weapons of mass destruction that then became the predicate for George H.W. Bush's Sonny Boy to invade Iraq in 2003, which, of course, I believe there were a couple of lies to the United Nations about that. In October of 1992, William Safire, reporter for the New York Times, talked of Barr's unwillingness to appoint an independent counsel to look into Iraqgate, the then sale of WMD to Saddam Hussein. Quote, why does the cover-up general resist independent investigation? Because he knows where it may lead. To James Baker, Clayton Newton, Brent Scowcroft, and himself, he vainly hopes to be able to head it off or at least be able to use the threat of firing to negotiate a deal. Well, that's basically what happened. Again, this is Mr. Safire in the New York Times now, August of 92. Mr. Barr could face prosecution himself if it turns out that high-level Bush officials knew about Saddam Hussein's perversion of our agriculture export guarantees to finance his war machine. You know, nothing like slipping in a few guns with the agricultural export guarantee, right? That's what we're talking about here. He added, they, Barr, and his colleagues have a keen personal and political interest in seeing to it that the Department of Justice stays in safe, controllable Republican hands. Yeah. So he then, in summary, blocked the appointment of an independent investigator to look into the sale of WMD to Saddam Hussein back in the late 80s and early 90s. So let's summarize, shall we? Right? In case you've lost track. Iran-Contra, including basically the fixing of the 1980 election by Reagan making a deal with the Ayatollah to not release the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose. The then sale of arms to Iran, which was illegal because of an embargo to fund the Contras in Nicaragua because the Nicaraguan government was socialist. Which, oh, by the way, Congress had made that illegal. That is, the funding of the Contras in Nicaragua, that was called the Boland Amendment. That was Iran-Contra. Then followed Iraqgate, another investigation that Bill Barr squashed. And then we turn to his role as Donald Trump's bagman, after being a pretty effective bagman for Presidents Reagan and HW. He kept the Mueller report from the public, and then he lied about it. And then when it finally did become public, he redacted so much of it so that he wouldn't get caught in the lies to the public, except for the fact that a federal judge wrote a 23-page opinion that called Bill Barr a liar. That was the Mueller report. We got the Turkish bankers, which he let off the hook because Trump asked him to, because Trump likes Erdogan because he's, you know, a strong dictator type guy. We've got the Kerry investigation under the Logan Act, which makes it illegal to engage in foreign policy when you're not in elected office, which, oh, by the way, Trump's doing today. And of course, we have, last but not least, the voter manipulation, the cover-up of the hush money payment that also was a federal crime that Donald Trump now faces criminal prosecution for under the state laws of New York. That's Bill Barr. In my opinion, one of the scariest men on the planet, because there is no morality, there is no ethical core, there is no bright line. He doesn't know what the public trust is because he violates it nearly every time the man opens his mouth. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can just listen to him. Let's take some sound, shall we? Let's start with 8B, if we will. This is Bill Barr talking about Donald Trump.
He put the country at risk if he was in the White House again?
He will always put his own interests and gratifying his own ego ahead of everything else, including the country's interests. There's no question about it. This is a perfect example of that. He's like, you know, he's like a nine-year-old, a defiant nine-year-old kid who's always pushing the glass toward the edge of the table, defying his parents to stop him from doing it. It's a means of self-assertion and exerting his dominance over other people. And he's a very petty individual who will always put his interests ahead of the country's, his personal gratification of his, you know, of his ego. But our country can't, you know, can't be a therapy session for, you know, a troubled man like this.
Okay, and now let's listen to cut 7, Bill Barr just last week with Caitlin Collins.
So just to be clear, you're voting for someone who you believe tried to subvert the peaceful transfer of power, that can't even achieve his own policies, that lied about the election even after his attorney general told him that the election wasn't stolen. And as the former chief law enforcement in this country, you're going to vote for someone who is facing 88 criminal counts.
Well, look, the 88 criminal counts, a lot of those are, in my, and I've said...
Even if 10 of them are accurate.
The answer to the question is yes. I'm supporting the Republican ticket.
But can you say that you're voting for Donald Trump? Because you're not saying his name. You just say you're supporting the Republican ticket.
I've said, as between Biden and Trump, I will vote for Trump. Because I...
Wait a minute. Let's listen to 8B again.
Put the country at risk if he was in the White House again?
He will always put his own interests and gratifying his own ego ahead of everything else, including the country's interests. There's no question about it.
This man is dangerous. And my point, as I began the show to you today, is how important it is for lawyers and judges to understand their most grave, their most sincere responsibility to ensure that people that put their personal interests ahead of the country's interests don't become president again. That someone who can't behave better than a 9-year-old who will turn the country into a therapy session doesn't become president again. That you have some set of most fundamental values, that for a public servant should always be serving the public. I don't know about you, but Bill Barr scares me more than Donald Trump does. Why? Because he actually has the smarts, the knowledge of how government operates to help a man like Donald Trump turn the Oval Office into a den, a center of crime that Justice Jackson warned us about last week. If we have time, let's take a listen to that. This is Cut 4.
If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? It's right now the fact that we're having this debate because OLC has said that presidents might be prosecuted. Presidents from the beginning of time have understood that that's a possibility. That might be what has kept this office from turning into the kind of crime center that I'm envisioning. But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want, I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
Yeah. That's exactly the point, because without the people like Bill Barr, Donald Trump can't commit those crimes. Without people like Bill Barr, there is no Iran-Contra affair. There is no cover-up. Without people like Bill Barr, Donald Trump isn't getting away with these criminal conspiracies. We sold arms to Iran to fund an anti-government group back in the 80s. We sold weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And we're now helping the next criminal mastermind get away with it. And the we here ain't we, it's Bill Barr, the most scary man on the planet, because he has the smarts to enable someone like Donald Trump, who's using the country as a therapy session, to return to power. I'm Maggie Dawn. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more on the Civic Media Radio Network in just a few. Yeah, I can love me.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. On the network, we've got coming up this afternoon, Busted Pencils. They're going to be live from the tap room of the Monaco Brewing Company at 6 p.m. And if that doesn't suit your fancy, don't worry. We have got the Brewers versus the Tampa Bay Rays at 6:05 on WRCE. WRJN and WISS. I'll be listening to one or both of them, maybe during the commercial breaks for the Brewers. I'll flip over to Busted Pencils so I can stay tuned in on the education scene here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. We've been talking about Bill Barr this afternoon because the man actually makes me somewhat afraid, and I'm not afraid of much. When you take who he is and the cover-ups that he's been involved with over the course of 40 years, the arrogance, the smugness with which he brushes off principles and ethics and the public's trust, and you couple that with the Supreme Court, the five men on the Supreme Court seeming complete lack of concern about incentivizing criminality, especially in the light of what can be only incredibly morally complicated, maybe even criminal acts by prior administrations, how they so blithely can walk into and embrace the idea of presidential immunity. And to be considering this in light of Donald Trump's criminal trial for inciting an insurrection, stopping the peaceful transfer of power, can only be the most dangerous thing our republic has ever faced? I mean, Liz Cheney is out there calling it, right? Very clearly saying to people, listen, we'll have the policy debates again. We'll go back to arguing about trickle-down economics and taxes and Social Security and education funding and Medicare and all that stuff. But now isn't the time. Let's take a listen. We're going to see what we got. This is going to be cut 8D. Again, this is Bill Barr's interview with Caitlin Collins just last week. Let's take a listen.
I hear from a lot of Republicans who defend Trump saying, well, that's a hypothetical and that's ridiculous. But Alyssa Farah Griffin, who was Trump's communications director, posted yesterday and said that you were present at a moment when Trump suggested executing the person who leaked information that he went to the White House bunker when those George Floyd protests were happening outside the White House. Do you remember that?
I remember him being very mad about that. I actually don't remember him saying executing, but I wouldn't dispute it. You know, I mean, it doesn't sound, the president would lose his temper and say things like that. I doubt he would have actually carried it out. I don't, you know.
But he would say that on other occasions? You said
the
he
president,
would lose his temper?
The president had a, I think people sometimes took him too literally, and you know, he would say things like similar to that in occasions to blow off steam. But I wouldn't take him literally every time he did it.
Why not?
Because at the end of the day, it wouldn't be carried out and you could talk sense.
But just because it's not carried out and you could talk sense into him, doesn't that still mean that the threat is there?
No, I mean, I think... I don't think the threat is there. The thing that I worry about President Trump is not that he's going to become an autocrat and do those kinds of things.
Why not?
Because I don't think he would.
But
at the end of the day,
what's the basis for that understanding that you have?
Well,
or is it just your own hunch?
That's my feeling, having worked for him and seen him in action. I don't think he would actually go and kill political rivals and things like that.
I'm sorry, what? We're supposed to trust your feeling, Bill Barr? Your feelings worked out so well with Iran-Contra in Iraqgate. Your feelings, Bill Barr? Are you the same guy that also said this? We're going to listen to Cut 8B again. Your feelings that he won't actually kill someone?
He put the country at risk if he was in the White House again?
He will always put his own interests and gratifying his own ego ahead of everything else, including the country's interests. There's no question about it. This is a perfect example of that. He's like, you know, he's like a nine-year-old, a defiant nine-year-old kid who's always pushing the glass toward the edge of the table, defying his parents to stop him from doing it. It's a means of self-assertion and exerting his dominance over other people. And he's a very petty individual who will always put his interests ahead of the country's, his personal gratification of his, you know, of his ego. But our country can't be a therapy session for, you know, a troubled man like this.
But Mr. Barr, we're supposed to trust your feeling that he won't actually go and kill political rivals and things like that. This, the man who needs to exert dominance and has to self-assert. Well, I don't know what amounts or what equates to dominance more than killing political rivals. And we're supposed to trust your feeling? The bag man of bag men? The cover-up general? Where is your shame, sir? Where is your fidelity to Constitution and country, to community? I don't know what motivates this man, but whatever it is, it ain't a scent of principles or morals or ethics, and it is not public service. Bill Barr is an abrogation, the most clear abrogation of a public servant's first duty, and that is to serve and to serve the public trust by preserving the public's trust in government. It ain't easy, it ain't always pretty, but that is the first and only principle. An attorney general, I can think of a few other words for Mr. Bill Barr. These are the times we live in, and it is high time for well-meaning Wisconsinites and Americans of every faith, of every background, of every race, and of every political persuasion to stand up and say no to the Bill Barrs of the world, to restore our faith in one another, our trust in one another, because those are the things that we value, and those truths are self-evident. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Devil's Advocates are next. And remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
I'ma keep running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.